Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Good evening. Thanks for coming out tonight. It's raining. Gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you here to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Lawrence Ferlinghetti. My name is Kenneth Clark. I'm the executive director of the Poetry Center of Chicago. Founded to be in residence in 1973 at the Museum of Contemporary Art by Paul Carroll and his team of Chicago poets, the Poetry Center has presented hundreds of the world's poets to the people of Chicago. It's our 30th year. 30 years of poetry for the people is something that we as Chicagoans can be proud of. The Poetry Center's Board of Directors and I and the volunteers and the staff are thrilled to offer you this evening's event as well as others this year and next. If you haven't already done so, pick up our brochure with Claus Oldenburg's back column on the front. It has information just about all you need to know about the Poetry Center and then some. And also make sure to pick up our new Hands on Stanzas brochure. Hands on Stanzas is in its seventh year, and it pays Chicago poets to be in residence in Chicago public schools to teach students how to read and write poetry. Students learn how to engage with our wonderful but complicated language, and this makes them better readers and writers and poets at the same time. None of this is easy to accomplish, but the Poetry Center has many friends. I especially want to thank our volunteers back at the sound box in the back and at the tables and the front desk. That's all volunteers. We also have a wonderful staff of now three, including myself, Shirley Stevenson and Kim Bannett. And also our members. We have over 300 members now, and if you're not a member, please join. We do need your help. I must recognize the many foundations and organizations that help make all of this possible. The Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute, and they let us use this wonderful facility and give us a humble but effective office space. Major programming support comes from the Poetry Center's members. Lannan Foundation, Target Stores, the Lewis R. Lurie Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, the Chicago Community Trust, Polk Brothers Foundation, Alan and Susan Turner, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Novi Family Foundation, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Chicago Community Trust, Young Leaders Fund, Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs, and the Chicago Sun-Times. This is a growing list. It makes me very proud that all these places are helping us meet the demands of our charter. I also want to thank CanTV, who is Alfonso and Juan here, who are recording this for later broadcast to the Cable Access Network's million-plus viewers, and also Alien Sound, a Chicago-based music and sound production company who is helping the Poetry Center record and then reproduce tonight's reading. You'll be able to buy that later on sometime next year. Tonight's event will consist of live poetry and a short book signing immediately after the reading. There is a reception afterwards. Please talk to somebody at one of the tables if you want to come to the reception. About a year ago, I met Louis Manilow. While I was talking to a small group of people, I mentioned that the Poetry Center had indeed been founded by Paul Carroll. And Mr. Manilow came up to me afterwards and said, "I knew Paul Carroll. I helped him with Big Table and all the exciting goings-on of poetry in Chicago in 1959. I was still learning about the origins and history of the Poetry Center at that time, and this came as great news to me. I also quickly learned that Mr. Manilow had helped out with a couple other little projects in town, being a former founding board member of the Museum for Contemporary Art, also a president, and he was also a driving force behind the movement to establish the city's redeveloped theater district, a movement which has literally helped revitalize Chicago's Loop. And he's now helping the Poetry Center take greater strides to fulfill its charter of building audience for poetry. Please welcome Louis Manilow, who will introduce tonight's poet.
Thank you, Ken. Chicago, thanks you for all the good work you've done with Poetry Center, and thanks you for getting this event. Look at the crowd, the wonderful people out for poetry. Let us bless all of you who have done that. Age has its privileges, and because I was around in the 50s and knew a lot of the players, they asked me to do the introduction of our wonderful poet tonight. We had a great scene in the 50s, and I want to talk about it for just a minute before we get to Mr. Ferlinghetti. The art was wonderful. We had Cliff Westerman and Leon Golub and June Leaf. The architecture was superb. There was a center here that came out of the Bauhaus, which was about the only center I think we had, the Institute of Design. And many people, there was a spirit that came out of that operation. There was the music was folk music, at least in my memory, Dixieland. There was a wonderful cabaret called Gate of Horn by a guy named Albert B. Grossman. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but Odetta and many other folk singers, the greatest comic I ever knew, Lenny Bruce, performed there a number of times. Lenny spent a lot of time in Chicago, courtesy of the Chicago Police Department, who liked his act so much they wanted him to repeat it word for word, particularly the MF word, in front of the court. So he did that. He was glad to do that. We also had many other wonderful theater. We had, there was the beginnings of way before Second City. There was the Playwrights Theater. Ed Asner's the most famous graduate of that. We had the Compass Players, the Improvisational Theater, Mike Nichols, Elaine May. There was Mies van der Rohe and Dave Garraway and Saul Bellow and Studs Terkel and great photographers, Aaron Ziskin. And anyway, in my lifetime, this was the liveliest scene, the liveliest art scene since World War II. And the 50s was wonderful. And we didn't have many journals, but we had, of course, well, I'm going to mention two. First of all, we had this wonderful big table, which Paul Carroll, our leading poet, I don't know if you've ever seen the first copy, 59, was it, the big table. Notice the colors. Now, who would want to arrest such a magazine? Stars, blue, red, white, and blue. Anyway, it came out of another bit of litigation where the University of Chicago Review had published a lot of the poets, particularly Ginsberg and the whole California, San Francisco scene. The police were very interested in that. So was the administration of the University of Chicago. And voila, they moved over. Paul became the editor, and Big Table was born. I was lucky to be proud to be counsel for Paul and the Big Table, and also actually for my first client was Albert B. Grossman, who incidentally went on to manage, after he left Chicago, to create Peter, Paul, and Mary, manage Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin. He was one of the legends in that field. So the 50s were an exciting and important time. I must mention the second journal, Playboy. Believe it or not, Playboy had serious literary pretensions. Pretensions may be an unfair word. They published Jack Kerouac. They published a lot of other people like that. They hired local artists, believe it or not. Now, that fell by the wayside over the years, but it actually did support a lot of talented people in its very early days. And it, too, had a brush with the law, which I happened to be present at, neither side seemed to want to have much conflict, and nothing serious happened, as it did with Lenny Bruce and others. Now let me turn to our wonderful guest tonight, who was one of the true heroes of the 50s, two heroes nationally and internationally. He emerged as one of the leading figures in the 50s. He was born in Yonkers in 1919. He took a doctorate in poetry at the Sorbonne. After leaving the Sorbonne, he came to San Francisco, started a magazine and a bookstore a legendary magazine and bookstore named City Lights. And he has continued to write poetry since 1958. The marvelously titled first book, A Coney Island of the Mind. He is still writing wonderful poetry, and his recent book is called How to Paint Sunlight on the Side of a House. That title, How to Paint Sunlight on the Side of a House, takes its title from Edward Hopper's comment, "All I wanted to do was to paint sunlight on the side of a house." Mr. Ferlinghetti comments that all he wanted to do was to paint light on the walls of life, to paint light on the walls of life. And that is what he has done magnificently for half a century. So it's my pleasure to introduce a great poet who has provided so much light for all of us, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
I am your blind poet, but I am not Homer. I am your blind poet and painter. I am contemplating my navel. I am singing folk songs about the workers. I am singing about the downtrodden masses and the rich on their fat asses. I am the painter who feels with his fingers. I am the blind seeing eye poet. I see what you can't see. I'm your postmodern, past modern multimedia artist. I am the most avant of the avant. I'm site-specific and totally conceptual. Even the greatest critics have been baffled by my profundity. I once knew Andy Warhol, and I've slept with you-know-whom. And I'm a fast-speaking man. I am your deconstructed language poet. Your far-out poet, your wandering workshop poet, your university poet with tenure. Your Buddhist quietist poet. I go on poetry reading tours where everything is paid for. I hear everything and it's grist to my mill. I use it all to make great sound poetry or great concrete poetry that no one can see through. I'll paint you a profound picture. An action painting, a gestural painting, nothing but pure gesture. I'll write you a far-out song of common people. If I take off my mask, I'll see the real world for the first time. But I won't take it off. It fits too well. It's too comfortable. And I've got my career to think of, my life to think of. And we only have one life to live, and living well is the best revenge. Get your own blindfold. You'll have to face the world without it, and anyway, I'm too young to die. I'm an American, and Americans don't die. We're the conquerors. We're the new Roman emperors. We're conquering the world with global capitalism. I can see it, but you can't see it. It's the invisible empire. And democracy is capitalism. No more poor people. No more huddled masses in our empire. The rising tide lifts all boats, if you've got a boat. No more people starving and dying. No more hunger and torture and death, if you've got a boat. If you've got a boat. News from Chicago. Wittgenstein at the Hotel Burnham. Settled in the Hotel Berman, downtown Chicago, Washington Street. Sitting in the lobby by the fireplace, waiting for something to happen. Who knows what? I'm hoping for the best. For a most fascinating freak, for instance, to walk through the revolving door through which all life passes and repasses. I've been reading Gay Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein, and wondering why anything exists and why there is anything instead of nothing. Lost in space, that is the mystery of everything. And the hotel lobby and the humans in it, a perfect picture of today's state of affairs. And Wittgenstein's father was super rich, a super-rich industrialist who collaborated with the Nazis. And Wittgenstein inherited it all, but gave it all away. Millions, maybe billions. And took a job as a grade school teacher, even though he'd been appointed professor of philosophy at Cambridge. He loathed the academic life and never had a wife, although at one time he contemplated marrying and migrating to Russia to work as a laborer. He preferred workers to intellectuals and considered Western culture as putrefying. This was the 1920s and 1930s, and nothing has changed except his philosophy with aphorisms that rocked armchair philosophers, as well as later destructuring the deconstructionists and deriding Derrida's of academia. And yet, he too in the end couldn't solve the mystery of baffling existence of us in this fishbowl universe with our noses pressed against the glass. As I sit in this lobby looking through the plate glass window at the passing pluriverse and awaiting with antic apprehension the final revelation of everything. Written today. It's the World Series. And this is a former World Series team. Baseball Canto. Watching baseball, sitting in the sun, eating popcorn, reading Ezra Pound. And wishing Juan Marichal would hit a hole right through the Anglo-Saxon tradition in the first canto and demolish the barbarian invaders from Los Angeles. When the San Francisco Giants take the field and everybody stands up to the national anthem with some Irish tenor's voice piped over the loudspeakers with all the players struck dead in their places and the white umpires like Irish cops in their black suits and little black caps pressed over their hearts standing straight and still like at some funeral of a Blarney bartender. And all facing east as if expecting some great white hope or the Founding Fathers to appear on the horizon. But Willie Mays appears instead in the bottom of the first, and a roar goes up as he clouts the first one into the sun and takes off like a foot runner from Thebes. The ball is lost in the sun, and maidens wail after him, but he keeps running through the Anglo-Saxon epic. And Tito Fuentes comes up, looking like a bullfighter in his tight pants and small pointed shoes, and the right field bleachers go mad with Chicanos and blacks and Brooklyn beer drinkers. Sweet Tito, sock it to him, sweet Tito. And sweet Tito puts his foot in the bucket and smacks one that don't come back at all and flees around the bases like he's escaping from the United Fruit Company. As the gringo dollar beats out the pound, and sweet Tito beats it out like he's beating out usury, not to mention fascism and anti-Semitism. And Juan Marichal comes up, and the Chicano bleachers go loco again as Juan belts the first fastball out of sight and rounds first and keeps going and rounds second and rounds third and keeps going and hits pay dirt to the roars of the grungy populace as some nut presses the backstage panic button for the tape-recorded national anthem again to save the situation. But it don't stop nobody this time in their revolution round the loaded white bases. In this last of the great Anglo-Saxon epics in the Territorio Libre of baseball. These These are from a book about 2 years old, A Far Rockaway of the Heart. Number two, driving a cardboard automobile without a license at the turn of the century, my father ran into my mother on a fun ride at Coney Island. Having spied each other eating in a French boarding house nearby, and having decided right there and then that she was for him entirely, he followed her into the playland of that evening, where the headlong meeting of their ephemeral flesh on wheels hurdles them forever together, and I, now in the back seat of their eternity, reaching out to embrace them. This is the only poem I ever wrote about the Beat Generation. And Pablo Neruda, that Chilean omnivore of poetry, who wanted to put everything in and take nothing out of his Canto General, said to me in Havana Libre Hilton, 1959, "I love your wide-open poetry." By which he meant a certain kind of poesia norteamericana and its rebel band who rose over the rooftops of tenement boneyards intent on making out and made out of madness 100 years of beatitude. "So boring, I'm snoring," cried Joe Public before they came along and busted out the sides of Poetry Chicago and various New Yorkerish poet tasters out of their Westchester cradles endlessly rocking on the Times Square shuttle between the Times Book Review and the Algonquin, while lady critics and gent professors moaned about poetic pederasts at Columbia. They cruised Times Square and America and cruised into history, waving genitals and manuscripts, and tuned their holy, unholy voices to a wide-open society that didn't even yet exist. And so jump-started the stalled merry-go-round of American ecstasy, left along East River's echoing shores after old Walt stepped off Brooklyn Ferry into the heart of America. These are just numbered. Number 21. Oh, heart, involuntary muscle. Oh, heart, heart, mute lover without a tongue of your own. Oh, heart, I would speak for you whenever you, seeing a certain someone, feel love. There should be some silence between poems, like space between pictures at an exhibition. But I've got so much to read here, I want to push off on you. I mean, as long as you'll sit still. Number 25. An obscure composer she was, but not so obscure as to compose obscure musics. She composed people instead into amorous clusters at her summer musters at the old homestead so that they fell naturally into each other's armatures. And no harm if yours was among the few that fell further into the too deep grass where swain might meet swain or lad meet lad or lad meet lass. And many were the swain songs as swan met swan and ass, ass. Number 28. I heard a woman making love today to some beast. Through the wall I heard her voice cry out in ecstasy or pain or joy at least. And it was too late to do anything about it except go with it or doubt it. Instead, I ran through the streets wearing a mask and singing mad songs, then fell into a zoo, tore off my clothes, and sprung in among the animals, those adepts at loneliness, and lay down with them in that unpeaceable kingdom and fell asleep like a gypsy dreaming of a lioness lover. San Francisco art scene. It really happened. Number 37. The party hoppers, wolfing down the wine and cheese, without a glance at what might be considered art, at all those Thursday evening openings at San Francisco galleries, and the critics and the crickets, and the singles out to score, and the docents of the donor classes, sheathed in silk and Christian Dior, holding long-stemmed glasses, with the tide of tinkled voices rising, and the painter to one side apprising the whole uprising, as if from a most distant shore, and saying over to himself, "Is this what I am painting for?" No wonder then that he, adrift in this society, doth drink too much and roll upon the floor. Number 45. Oh, you gatherer of the fine ash of poetry, ash of the too white flame of poetry, consider those who have burned before you in the so white fire. Crucible of Keats and Campana, Bruno and Sappho, Rambo and Poe and Corso, and Shelley burning on the beach at Viareggio. And now, in the night, in the general conflagration, the white light still consuming us, small clowns with our little tapers held to the flame. I never had so many people watching me drink before. Too bad it isn't wine. The last one in this book. Wearing a Polonaire's derby, I am in a Zeppelin with 100 dignitaries in tailcoats from all over the world, cruising about looking for a place to declare peace, personal and universal, looking for a soft landing for peace on earth. Gardens are sighted on the horizon and the airship veers in that direction only to discover there is no airfield. And we veer off again. The sky is lit with flares. A man in tails with wings jumps off the Eiffel Tower, thinking he's a bird. It's in the Pathé News. He plummets straight down in front of his friends. I am a boy picking petals off a sunflower in Provence. It's midsummer. A million crickets sound their huge drone in the night. A sunflower leans in a window where I am a boy leaning out. Lulu, Lulu, someone calls. I have picked all the petals. They fall. Lulu, où es-tu? It is hot in the dark room. There are riots in France and Italy. The Americans killed Sacco and Vanzetti. I saw Lindbergh land. The Zeppelin sails on. There is jazz on the wireless. It's Sidney Bechet, Paris, 1930s. The dignitaries toasting each other in champagne and American cigarettes. The pilot sends a Morse code greeting to a ship at sea. The band plays on. The captain sends back a round of drinks on the house. Sailing through the hot night, an endless flight around the world, we gaze out the portals of the crystal gondola at the endless stars. Night reveals the city of the earth with lit with leftover sun. The dirigible soars in the summit of heaven. The Zeppelin flies on into the 21st century. The Zeppelin is life itself, the zone we fly through, endless, without borders, without boundaries. There are no more nations. Migrant populations sweep the earth in search of food and shelter. We throw down our champagne glasses. The TV shows the endless night sky. We are watching an eclipse. The universe, endless, stretches away in endless night. There must be a place where all is light. Where then, O endless one, in endless eternity? Where now? We are heavenly bodies, wrapped in time, hurtling through bent space. Flameouts illuminate the landscape.
True, the most advanced science is sometimes very poetic. Like Olber's paradox posited that in the far distance everything must be light, because the further and further away you get from Earth, the more and more clusters of stars there are, and in the furthest distances just huge masses of stars clustered together. And the reason we still have night at all is because the light from that place where all is light hasn't got here yet. This book just came out. It's called How to Paint Sunlight: Instructions to Painters and Poets. I asked 100 painters and 100 poets how to paint sunlight on the face of life. Their answers were ambiguous and ingenuous, as if they were all guarding trade secrets. Whereas it seems to me all you have to do is conceive of the whole world and all humanity as a kind of artwork, a site-specific artwork, an art project of the God of light, the whole earth and all that's in it, to be painted with light. And the first thing you have to do is to paint yourself in your true colors as you see them. Paint yourself as you see yourself, without makeup, without masks. Then paint your favorite people and animals with your brush loaded with light. And be sure you get the perspective right and don't fake it, because one false line leads to another. And then paint the high hills when the sun first strikes them. On an autumn morning, with your palette and life, lay it on the cadmium yellow leaves, the ochre leaves, the vermilion leaves of a New England autumn, and paint the ghost light of summer nights and the light of the midnight sun, which is moonlight. And don't paint out the shadows made of light, for without chiaroscuro, you'll have shallow pictures. So paint all the dark corners too, all the hidden places and minds and hearts which light never reaches, all the caves of ignorance and fear, the pits of despair, the sloughs of despond, and write plain upon them, abandon all despair, ye who enter here. And don't forget to paint all those who live their lives as bearers of light. Paint their eyes and the eyes of every animal, and the eyes of men and women, known only for the light of their minds. Paint the light of their eyes, the light of sunlit laughter, the song of eyes, the song of birds in flight. And remember that the light is within, if it is anywhere, and you must paint from the inside. Start with purity, with pure white, the pure white of gesso, the pure white of cadmium white, the pure white of flake white, the pure virgin canvas, the pure life we all begin with. Turner painted sunlight with egg tempera, which proved unstable, and Van Gogh did it with madness, and the blood of his ear, also unstable, and the Impressionists did it by never using black, and the Abstract Expressionists did it with white house paint. But you can do it with the pure pigment of your own true light. But before you strike the first blow on the virgin canvas, remember to remember its fragility, life's extreme fragility, and remember its innocence, its original innocence, before you strike the first blow, or perhaps never strike it, and let the light come through, the inner light of the raw canvas, the inner light of the models posed in the life study, the inner light of everyone. Let it all come through like a pentimento, the light that's been painted over, the life that's been painted over so many times. Let it all surge to the surface, the painted over image of primal life. And when you're finished your painting, stand back astonished. Stand back and observe the life on earth that you've created, the lighted life on earth that you've created, a new brave world. Enough of philosophizing and get down to some concrete observation now. Yat-Zin Sun, San Francisco. The yachts, the white yachts with their white sails in sunlight, catching the wind and heeling over, all together racing now for the white buoy to tack about, to come about beyond it, and then come running in before the spanking wind, white spinnakers billowing off Fort Mason, San Francisco, where once drowned down an Alcatraz con escaping, whose bones today are sand 50 fathoms down, still imprisoned now in the glass of the sea as the so skillful yachts freely pass over. Slight theft from William Carlos Williams there. Big Sur Light, it's a little too, I'll just skip through it, it's too long for all of the parts. How lovely the earth and all the creatures in it, shining in eternity, in dearth and death of night, as the sun shakes out its shining hair of streaming light. The birds slept in this morning, not a word out of them until sunup. Usually they're out there just before light, tuning up, chirring away to themselves about the nature of light, for which they're always yearning, or about the earth and why it never stops turning. Big questions for birds to settle and tell us in single syllables before breakfast. The moon, after much reflection, says, "Sun is God." The tree believes its panoply of leaves will save it from acid rain. Think again. Will the rains ever end? Basho claps together his muddy clogs. Phallus in vulva and a divine spasm shakes the universe. Dictionaries of light. The sun comes round the corner like a shining knight of old, galloping over the landscape on the horses of morning. and shaking his lance over us in trance of night, awakens us to speak or sing, to banish death and darkness. And each steed a word, each verb a stallion, reared up against all ignorance, untamed, rampant radicals in dictionaries of light. Prague, 1998. My mind is racing in the middle of the night. My mind races through the darkness around the world, through the darkness of the world, toward a tunnel of light. It races through the night of Prague, through Staromak Square, with its John Hus sculpture reading, "Love each other and the truth will triumph." It races on through the night streets, across the Charles Bridge, across the river at the heart of Prague, across the rivers of the world, across the Rhine, across the Rhone, across the Seine, across the Thames, across Anna Livia's Liffey, across Atlantic, across Manhattan, across Great Hudson, into the heart of America. My heart is racing now across America, across Old Man River, rolling along. My heart is racing now across terrific Pacific, across the river of yellow light of Sun Yat-sen, across Gandhi's Ganges, across Euphrates, across the Nile, across the Hellespont, across Tiber, across Arno, across Dante's River Styx, through the medieval darkness, into the heart of the tunnel of light. My heart and mind are racing now together on the same beat to the same music. It's not the music of Carmina Burano. It's the music of Don Giovanni. It's Mozart's horn concerto. It's the yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. There is a sign in the light at the end of the tunnel. I am trying to reach it. We are all trying to read it. Dark figures dancing it in the half darkness. Light figures dancing it in the half light. Library scene, Manhattan. In the New York Public Library, in the Men's John, there's a lot of marble pews with a lot of guys in there praying that everything will come out all right. One guy looks like Samuel Gompers plotting another strike. Another looks like FDR, like he's deciding to announce a new deal. Another is maybe the slumming bottom line editor of some publishing conglomerate whom someone sent out to see what a real book looks like. Another is a nobody off the street who was snoozing on a park bench until he heard Mother Nature call, along with a ragged clergyman who also felt the call. Another looks like a little mafioso about to sing if he doesn't have to go to Sing Sing. Another looks like the crazy captain of this motley crew with his funny fisherman's hat askew, hiding loose screws. And now, of a sudden, there's a great flushing, a great rushing through clandestine fleet. And the whole crew in this listing freighter, laden with all the culture of the world, sailing on together through the postmodern weather. And this really happened. Oh, that's the job of the poet, to persuade the listener that everything really happened. the little dirty tongue, the little black dog with the small head and funny tail enters the little church of Santa Maria Acacia during Sunday Mass. And waving his tail, he wanders up to where the head priest is praying over microphones. And the dog sniffs the altar and cocks his head as if he is listening to the priest. And then he starts sniffing the front row worshipers who are now all kneeling and waiting with eyes closed and open mouths for communion. And the priest comes up and starts putting wafers on their extended tongues. And only those with clean tongues after confession are allowed to get the wafer. But the dog raises his paw very politely and paws the skirt of the priest with open mouth and tongue hanging out, for he too wants one of those delicious biscuits. But the priest ignores the dog because the dog has no soul, according to this antique legend. And anyway, his tongue is not by any means clean after all the faces and feces he has licked. And the dog can't get one of them holy biscuits. No such luck for the soulless mutt who now slinks away like a starving heathen on the far, far outskirts of the Roman Empire. Blood of the Bag Lady. Happy he who held those breasts, apples of bliss, blissfully hanging once upon a time. Now, she of the broken bust stumbles across the street looking for butts, old bag of blood with a history to tell of where all that blood came from, coursing through generations of generations. All those swimming, unsinkable genes in veins and arteries of the world, sailing through rife humanity, through that beat body, a walking gene pool, teeming tide pool, born of oceans, mother of us all. Fit this in. It sort of relates to the Great Lakes. Sort of. It does, in fact. The freights. The long freights let out their lonely shrieks in the Lake Erie dawn. In fruit of first light, their boxcars strung out endless, horizon to horizon. Engines disappeared westward, and their ends still not visible over the cornfields. The corn itself stacked high in the open bins, cradles rocking across America toward Huron, Sandusky, Port Clinton, Toledo. Admiral Perry offshore sends up his signals off Put-in Bay. The wind shifts, and its flagship drifts, becalmed in the middle distance. He's raked by British broadsides. He rows to another ship carrying his flag with him. He closes on the British brigs and blasts them with his cannonades and carries the day. The battle is won for free trade in all the Northwest Territory. As Chief Tecumseh shakes his hopeless feather lances and disappears over the horizon, and the freights roll on, endless, over the Northwest Territory, over the American Empire, past Lake Erie, past Huron, past Buffalo, gateway to the West, the new Athens. From Cleveland to Detroit to Chicago, hog-faced brawler. Ah, But there is an end in sight. Here it comes. As we idle at a crossing, red lights flashing, the railroad bell ringing, here comes the end of it, the end of all our imaginings. And no caboose, no ghost brakeman hanging out from the last platform, railroad cap cocked up, swinging his lantern. Yet still the train cries out, crying far away like the sea, sending its lonely signal to the good townsfolk, to the good burghers eating burgers, becalmed in backwaters of shopping malls and filling stations. And Admiral Perry, still offshore, unsure of what bright future he was fighting for. This is Apollinaire in America. It's a ripoff of Guillaume Apollinaire's most famous poem in his book, Alcohols. Sous le pont Mirabeau coule la Seine. Over the high Sierras flies the plane, and our loves too. Must I remember them again? Joy comes often after pain. Hands upon each other, we lay close together. In halcyon weather, in the high Sierra, long ago, came the night, told the time, from zone to zone the hours pass, and I remain. Love passed slowly, long ago, when life was slow. Now time and love are swift upon the plain. Time and love go by, and I remain. Past the hours, past the days, neither time nor love's come back again. Over the far Sierra flies the plane. Into the interior. I am your whispered voice, your inside voice, your interior voice, your unheard voice, your unspoken voice, your unvoiced voice, your unspeakable voice. I am your heart's voice and your heartless voice, your deepest voice, under layers of living and speaking, the voice of your buried life, your invisible life, your silent life, your unknown life, your unopened life, your unrealized life, the undiscovered life that no one sees, not even your lover, not even yourself. If you will listen to me, if you will lend me the ear of your mind and of your bent heart, if you will heed my whisperings, only heed my whisperings, heed my whisperings, heed my whisperings. Allen Ginsberg's been dead three years or so now, and so many people wish he were alive for what he would be saying after 9/11. Allen Ginsberg dying. Allen Ginsberg is dying. It's in all the papers. It's on the evening news. A great poet is dying, but his voice won't die. His voice is on the land, in lower Manhattan, in his own bed. He is dying. There is nothing to do about it. He is dying the death that everyone dies. He is dying the death of the poet. He has a telephone in his hand, and he calls everyone from his bed in lower Manhattan. All around the world, late at night, the telephone is ringing. This is Allen, the voice says. Allen Ginsberg calling. How many times have they heard it over the long, great years? He doesn't have to say Ginsberg. All around the world, in the world of poets, there is only one Allen. I wanted to tell you, he says. He tells them what's happening, what's coming down on him. Death, the dark lover, going down on him. His voice goes by satellite over the land, over the Sea of Japan, where he once stood naked, trident in hand, like a young Neptune, a young man with black beard, standing on a stone beach. It is high tide, and the seabirds cry. The waves break over him now, and the seabirds cry on the San Francisco waterfront. There is a high wind. There are great white caps lashing the Embarcadero. Allen is on the telephone. His voice is on the waves. I am reading Greek poetry. The sea is in it. Horses weep in it. The horses of Achilles weep in it. Here by the sea in San Francisco, where the waves weep, they make a sibilant sound, a sibylline sound. Allen, they whisper, Allen. Spoken to the Oracle at Delphi at the UNESCO World Poetry Day in Delphi, Greece, March 21st, 2001. To the Oracle at Delphi, great Oracle, why are you staring at me? Do I baffle you? Do I make you despair? I, Americus, the American, wrought from the dark in my mother, long ago, from the dark of ancient Europa. Why are you staring at me now, in the dusk of our civilization? Why are you staring at me as if I were America itself, the new empire vaster than any in ancient days, with its electronic highways carrying its corporate monoculture around the world, and English, the Latin of our day? Great Oracle, sleeping through the centuries, awaken now at last and tell us how to save us from ourselves and how to survive our own rulers. Who would make a plutocracy of our democracy in the great divide between the rich and the poor, in whom Walt Whitman heard America singing? Oh, long silent Sybil, you of the winged dreams, speak out from your temple of light. As the Sirius constellations with Greek names still stare down on us, as a lighthouse moves its megaphone over the sea, speak out and shine upon us, the sea light of Greece, the diamond light of Greece, far-seeing Sybil, forever hidden, come out of your cave at last and speak to us in the poet's voice, the voice of the fourth person singular, the voice of the inscrutable future, the voice of the people mixed with a wild, soft laughter. And give us new dreams to dream. Give us new myths to live by. And Joseph Campbell said, we have no myths of our own to live by. History of the airplane. And the Wright brothers said they thought they had invented something that could make peace on Earth if the wrong brothers didn't get hold of it. When their wonderful flying machine took off at Kitty Hawk into the kingdom of birds. But the Parliament of Birds was freaked out by this man-made bird and fled to heaven. And then the famous Spirit of St. Louis took off eastward and flew across the big pond with Lindy at the controls in his leather helmet and goggles, hoping to sight the doves of peace. But he did not, even though he circled Versailles. And then the famous Flying Clipper took off in the opposite direction and flew across the terrific Pacific. But the Pacific doves were frighted by this strange amphibious bird and hid in the orient sky. And then the famous Flying Fortress took off, bristling with guns and testosterone, to make the world safe for peace and capitalism. But the birds of peace were nowhere to be found before or after Hiroshima. And then, and so then, clever men built bigger and faster flying machines, and these great man-made birds with jet plumage flew higher than any real birds and seemed about to fly into the sun and melt their wings and, like Icarus, crash to earth. And the Wright brothers were long forgotten in the high-flying bombers that now began to visit their blessings on various third worlds, all the while claiming they were searching for doves of peace. And they kept flying and flying until they flew right into the 21st century. And then one fine day, a third world struck back and stormed the great plains and flew them straight into the beating heart of skyscraper America, where there were no aviators and no parliaments of doves. And in a blinding flash, America became a part of the scorched earth of the world. And a wind of ashes blows across the land, and for one long moment in eternity, there was chaos and despair, and buried loves and voices, cries and whispers fill the air everywhere. Are there not still fireflies? Are there not still fireflies in America? Are there not still four-leaf clovers? Is not our land still beautiful? Our fields not full of armed enemies? Our cities never bombed by foreign invaders? Never occupied by iron armies speaking iron tongues? Are not our warriors still valiant, ready to defend us? Are not our senators still wearing fine togas? Are we not still a great people in the greatest country in all the world? Is this not still a free country? Are not our fields still ours? Our gardens still full of flowers? Our ships with full cargoes? Why then do some still fear the barbarians coming, coming, coming in their huddled masses? What is that sound that fills the air, drumming, drumming? Is not Rome still Rome? Is not Los Angeles still Los Angeles? Is not beauty still beauty? And truth still truth? Are there not still poets? Are there not still lovers? Are there not still mothers, sisters, and brothers? Is there not still a full moon once a month? Are there not still fireflies? Are there not still stars at night? Can we not still see them in bowl of night, signaling to us our manifest destinies?